You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space, a monthly podcast of artist talks, panel discussions, and other events.
Tēnā tātou katoa. Nō mai hoki mai ki tēnei kaupapa kōrero o The Physics Room. Nō mai, whakarongo mai, whakatau mai. My name is Abby Kinane and I'm the director of The Physics Room, a contemporary art space dedicated to developing and promoting contemporary art and critical discourse in Aotearoa. Based in central Ōtautahi since 1996, we assist artists with resources and opportunities to enable creative and professional development and work to support the acknowledgement and understanding of contemporary art among New Zealanders. Our goal is to actively seek links between the arts and other areas of cultural production, and to involve art as a contributing voice in wider intellectual, social, and political debate.
Kia ora tātou. My name is Orissa Keane, and I am the Writing and Publications Coordinator at The Physics Room, and this is episode 45 of Art Not Science. In this episode, we'll be sharing a selection of readings from Correspondence Issue 2.1, The Physics Room's biannual serial publication. Correspondence publishes works for the page and ear as openings into and through artistic practices and relationships. In this issue, I invited contributors to respond to something I wrote which explores what a spacious atrium could be. Jane Wallace, David Garcia, Ziggy Lever, Isla Martin, and Erin Lee will be reading their contributions, and you can find Balamohan Shingade and Nkosi Nkululeko's collaborative text on our website, or by picking up a copy of Correspondence from our gallery. First, I'll share with you Spacious Atrium.
This atrium is vast, but, like gas, it fills whatever container it is offered. Mostly it takes the shape of the in-between, the height above clouds, the pocket of air beneath a bird's wings, whether in flight or stationary. It fills the seaweed vase when it holds no flowers. It is the space between the binding and the cover within the spine of a book when it is opened. It is held and ejected by the sound between lips and teeth. It occupies the trachea, but it does not speak for itself, so it continues to seek out spaces within and without the body. The spacious atrium begins and ends as you walk through it. It seeks the spaces that describe the abundance it wants to represent. An atrium is a passageway of sorts. It holds a space for you, but you cannot stay within its boundary indefinitely. It doesn't always need a physical container. Sometimes a thought can contain a spacious atrium. Thoughts shared by more than one person. On any given surface, there is what's called a boundary layer. In the boundary layer, because of the friction on the surface, the air is still. The wind cannot enter. Because the air is still, it is warmer, and the moisture coming off the surface stays within the boundary layer. This is where mosses grow. You can mark the height of the boundary layer based on how tall the mosses are, growing within their own greenhouse of perfect conditions. The boundary layer acts like a spacious atrium, but some things like moss never leave the boundary layer, and one must have the intention of leaving the spacious atrium. I can't decide whether a car park is the same as a spacious atrium or its opposite. The shapes created by desire lines across the grass, ignoring the paved path, often mimic a spacious atrium. When it's windy, and there's rain on the wind, but you find a space around the side of a restaurant where it smells good and you're sheltered, and you can imagine being warm, that's a spacious atrium. Inside a public postbox is a spacious atrium, because things are constantly coming and going from it. Although this atrium is more like the atria of a heart, because there is only one point of entry and one point of exit, and who knows what would happen if this is reversed.
Next, Jane Wallace reads Fibrous Rhythm, introducing an atrium close to us here at the Physics Room in Ōtautahi, writing about Tikawe by Mata Aho Collective, a new artwork installed at Te Puna o Waiwhitu, Christchurch Art Gallery.
Fibrous Rhythm. Harakeke doesn't grow much in the Port Hills, but other fibrous things do. We, or silver tussock, cross-hatch the landscape in the northeasterly wind patterns. When it catches them just right, the slender blades hiss all the way from the lookout over Otokitoki to the gondola summit station. Mata Aho's Tikawe is an expansive work. 40 tightly braided bands of harakiki, each between 11 and 16 metres. Together, they amount to about 600 metres of weaving, a motion of one under, then one over, practised and repeated. The ends are finished with heavy ratchets, which are used to hold the tension and link to another exact belt, or bolted in parallel sets to the perimeter of Christchurch Art Gallery's atrium. The entrance to Te Puna or Waifetu is a glassy place and used to being hammered by bright afternoon sun. The transparent panes wrapping the facade bounce the light and draw high lines. I often think of this form like the shell of an insect, an articulated and translucent shelter for life to pass through. Tikawe suggests but does not record the passage of rays through the foyer. Instead, it might encase them, catch them, a net for a sun trap. The hills rise almost 600 metres. More precisely, the highest point is Makto Omawete at 573 metres, though I am sure that this distance might swell upward a little more along the ridgeline, or where the coast falls further down below. Either way, if every strap of Tikawe were to form a single cable, it could be anchored at the foot and offer a gentle handrail all the way to the top. With a heavy pack on, walking uphill, breathing becomes heavy too, and it is difficult to keep a steady pace. Heart rate increases as oxygen-deficient blood moves through its right atrium and the right ventricle, and then into the lungs, and back to the heart through the left atrium and the left ventricle. The phrase shouldn't be breathing room, but breathing rooms, a motel-shaped arrangement of chambers to come and go from. At first sight of Tikawe, it took me a moment to clock that it was made of plant matter. I initially assumed that Mata Aho had used the kind of domestic industrial material that they have previously employed and works like Kiko Moana or Aka, constructed from tarpaulin and marine rope respectively. Harakiki means there is an unknown element to the work and its longevity that differs from previous projects. Exposure to heat and sunlight may dry the fibre and cause it to tighten or slacken. However, Kawe have a tried and tested strength, and the addition of ratchets, transforming them into replicas of commonplace strops, is functional as well, as the work is able to respond to the effects of these environmental conditions. Tikawe does not just visually reference tie-downs, it utilises them as a practical solution that allows such large-scale weaving to be displayed, a spirited synthesis of technology. The apex of Urumau Reserve provides a vantage point down to the industry of the port. Not only the labour of the main quay, but also around the shadowy corner to where the vehicle carrying ships dock. Containers are hoisted off vehicles and new cargo is loaded onto them with the use of cranes and winches. It is easy to get caught up in the romance of the names of freighters. Maple Breeze, Cherry Dream, and the brightly coloured corrugated building blocks, but this is just a work day for a lot of people. Attaching two whiri together results in kawe, a customary innovation used to carry a heavy load on the back. Now in the gallery they're holding the space. What is the sculptural equivalent of a quickly beating heart? Can it be activated when more people start to circulate the area, creating pathways between threshold and internal cavity, and back into the external world? Mata Aho make with an awareness of the combined energy of their four brains and eight hands, and I guess that equates to four hearts too. Collaboration enables something that exists at a scale proportionate to the body, to be enlarged and shared beyond oneself, descending or starbound.
That was Jane Wallace reading Fibrous Rhythm. Next, you will hear David Garcia read Unsettling Cartographies, a proposal for the unsettling of conventional digital cartographic practices. In so doing, he invites readers to consider cartography as a generative and reparative tool in decolonizing methodologies.
Unsettling Cartographies by David Garcia. My professional background is in geography, geospatial analysis, and spatial planning. My ongoing work explores conditions of spatial vulnerability and risk, including conflict, the climate crisis, and colonialism. As a mapmaker, I respond out of necessity, given that these issues affect my peoples materially, spiritually, economically, and more. I am a native Kapampangan and Tagalog from the Philippines, living in Aotearoa, on Fenua of Kaitahu, who are my relatives as Austronesians. Here I present five maps, reflecting on the fluctuations, tangents, and developments within my mapmaking practice over the past 3 years. Due to many sources of inspiration, including professional, artistic, civic, and academic work, as mediated by networked and digital information technologies, and supported by the collectives I belong to. The first map introduces Austronesian connections between the Sea of Islands of the Pacific and Indian Oceans. Here in Aotearoa, I've noticed very similar words used by Tangata Fenua, speaking Tareo Māori, to those spoken back home in the Philippines. I find it amazing to experience these connections. Our wayfinding peoples have been expanding over thousands of years and kilometers. This map, which is inspired by the stick charts of our relatives in Lolelaplap, the Marshall Islands, is a deep and dynamic relational time-space that does not treat history and geography as a mere background. Rather, the relationships themselves make up the time and space which we navigate. I used my bed as a background. The original stick charts are educational tools for young wayfinders on land before they set out on the ocean. I made this one to illustrate our oceanic connections as Austronesians, whose cultures originated from southeastern Taiwan thousands of years ago in front of us. The second map is an articulation of a possible future, but one which I hope will never arrive. I made it during a phase in my life when I was filled with climate grief and very worried about the future of the Pacific and its peoples. For some, the storytelling of loss and damage is an important tool for raising awareness. However, I think and feel it can also be a trap in itself, because it is the very idea of salvation that has been at the core of colonialism. I made this map to express the overwhelmingly sad emotions I felt witnessing the globalizing world accelerate towards climate change and expecting folks like me to fade away. Today, I acknowledge the capacity of this map and this way of thinking to re-traumatize, and for this reason, regard it as a stumbling block on the way to ethical and effective climate action. The third map is a reflection on my career in the humanitarian industry. I used to work full-time in the cities and communities hit by disasters and war in the Philippines. My journey as a mapmaker has also involved working for international organizations on reconstruction and resilience initiatives. I have seen a lot of what actually happens in these places. According to Tyon J. Coleman, a poem can be a map to express what cannot usually be rendered in conventional digital cartography. As my work moves away from conventional cartography, I am continually inspired by Jim Enot, a Zuni mapmaker who said, "There are maps in songs and in prayers. There are maps that are etched in stones and woven into textile and painted in ceramics." The fourth map is an inversion of typical crisis mapping. Over the centuries, places and peoples in the global south, including those in the Philippines, have been painted as inhabiting red zones and dangerous lands full of disease, poverty, and emergencies, as explained by the historical geographer Greg Bankoff. In cartography, during the Renaissance, This ideology of rendering non-Western places as unsafe has manifested in the depiction of map monsters during a time when Europeans were defining themselves through judging the humanity of the other. Sureka Davis, an historian of art, science, and ideas, talks about the deeply embedded historical basis for this being, seemingly a mere embellishment practice that in fact helped provide justification for colonial projects. In other words, if you, as a European power, did not like another country, then paint them like an octopus. Such problematic practices persist today. What is usually not met in mainstream map-making is the role of colonialism and imperialism in the reproduction of crises. Whether through humanitarianism, militarism, developmentalism, or environmentalism. This is translated into modern geospatial dashboards, which are digital interactive visualizations of geographic information that again depict mostly the global south in a state of permanent emergency and in need of intervention and so-called development and progress. I felt compelled to offer my own intervention into this. Subverting their own cartographic traditions and propaganda, here is the United States Empire as a map monster, which has hundreds of military bases and countless geopolitical operations such as intelligence, diplomacy, espionage, and aid worldwide. The fifth map is about desire. Professor Eve Tuck has cautioned against the centering of damage in dealing with native and indigenous issues. Instead, she proposes to express desire. My desire, as a native Kapampangan and Tagalog, as well as an Austronesian, is to see our descendants in the future behind us enjoying life and the galaxies. The following map is about oceanic futurism, which has been largely inspired by indigenous futurism and Afrofuturism. Borrowing an image from the James Webb Space Telescope, here it looks like the seafloor because, for my peoples and relations, the ocean is the universe, is the ocean. In the future behind me, I would like to decenter the visual through unmapping, as mentioned by Professor Tauli Goff, whose work is in making auditory, gustatory, and many more kinds of spatial memories possible. With my relations, I am creating a collaborative playlist on Spotify called Astronesia. I hope to meet you there.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
That was David Garcia reading Unsettling Cartographies. Next, Ziggy Lever reads Image After Imago, a discursive search for the imago, the ideal snail, which may turn out to be just a shell and not a snail at all. The snail shell that sits mysteriously, whose occupation or vacancy is unsure.
Image After Imago. As a dyslexic person, I often turn to etymology to help me figure things out. Finding that words can be unravelled and their parts traced back through time has led to no end of joyful and creative misunderstandings and discoveries. Strange traces seem to appear between things as a word is picked apart. Proto-forms and senses are revealed under the layers, and in the shifting spellings and arrangements of letters, surprising connections are made. Unfortunately, this doesn't really help me in Scrabble. Finding an empty snail shell in the garden, I thought of the entomological etymologies of imago and image. Imago is a term that describes, of an insect, the stage at which it becomes sexually mature, a final form in the biological life cycle that leaves behind images of itself through trace, carapace, and cocoon. The imago stage is so called because it represents a kind of true image of the insect, the definitive version that casts off the mask of its previous representations. The fresh cicada, having emerged from its image, is considered an imago, the iconic version. But when is an insect really in imago, and for how long? Is imago a moment caught, passed by on the way to a different state? The moment imago begins for the snail is less clearly defined. There's no obvious eruption or shredding that occurs. Rather, a steady calcification of layers and gradual increase in size. Perhaps this is why the term is only applied to insects. Both image and imago can be traced from the Latin imitari, to copy or imitate, and further back to the Proto-Indo-European root word, aim. Perhaps imago is a symbolic form of the insect, the stage when it is most readily imagined and represented. How might images form after imago? In varying stages of hardening and softening, evidencing duration. What is the true image of the snail? If it is too difficult to ascertain the moment that when a snail is considered sexually mature, is the imago of the snail a classic picture of a fully grown adult snail? Is it a symbolic representation of a spiral shell, with its foot and antennae out, as in the portrait of the snail that hibernated in the British Museum for nearly 4 years? Or perhaps it's a snail's shell that sits mysteriously, whose occupation or vacancy is unsure. If the snail is the imago, the shell is perhaps an afterimage, an image after imago, trace evidence of the once living being that grew it. I think this interest in etymology has something to do with the idea of research, and how found images, citations, and other texts can become part of a project. In snail time, and across other collaborative exchanges with Lucy Mail since 2014, the presence of research within the installation has been a common thread. This is usually as a series of ephemera, pages or documents to be taken away or read within the installation. Sometimes this research is a sound work or a projected image. Usually it's compiled into a publication alongside other texts. I think we both feel that the way in which images and texts sit in relation to each other is important in our work, and that the goal is a kind of montage of meanings. Montage rather than collage, because a collage is a single image made up of other images, whereas a montage is a series of images that fold and unfold over duration, frames that flow meanings together. With each new secreted layer of shell, the snail builds up an archive of image traces. Do the lines between the segments represent a cut, as in film? If so, then it is a cutting together or a stitching. Montage, like archive and writing in general, promises a surplus value that there may be more and other meanings to what it says at the literal level. And what is the imago of an installation? Well, in its most basic life cycle, the installation is established, open to the public, and deinstalled. When opened, it reaches imago. Photographs are taken and uploaded to websites. People are invited for reviewing. The main images of the installation are made to represent the work in the future, but this fails to account for other stages, the research and planning that happens before access is given to a space, the initial realizations of difference between drawings and reality, the subtle and not so subtle material transformations that occur over its duration, the written responses made after the work is taken down. What traces those materials back to the installation after it disappears? How do they share a history as they are dispersed across archive boxes and in friends' houses and gardens? Between these stages are a series of faster life cycles that might contain their own imagos. The open and closed periods of the gallery or site, private viewings and public open hours, lunch breaks, back in five, the time it takes to turn the work on and off, troubleshooting, problems and mends, the change of light over the course of a day, and perhaps over several weeks passing between the seasons. Are these not all valid candidates for imago? Imago is the image, the perfect icon, and the aim of all mutations and transformations. For an installation, its documentation cements a point in time as the image, or images, puncturing other durations and experiences. Yet the documentation image is also an imitation of the installation, aim. The fictions of the camera remake the installation into an image. How then can an installation be more like the snail's shell, always image after imago? Can an installation cast off the mask of its previous representations? Collecting this research is often the first step towards our working together, something to share back and forth and then respond to. Images and texts operating as materials in the work. Through making, the research unravels, and connective tissues of meaning form across the project at hand. As the project continues and in each iteration, research becomes a research as we go over similar ground and return to ideas. The word research, from the old French word rechercheur, can be split into two actions. The first is re, which itself has two senses. Re means back, to move backwards or to return to a place, and also again, to repeat, to undo, turn over, renew. The origin of re is uncertain, but possibly comes from the Indo-European ret, to turn. The second action is searcher, to seek for, implying a forwards orientation and direction of looking. The word searcher can be traced further back to the Latin cercare, which means to go about, wander, traverse, and in turn from circus, see circle. Research as walking, circling back, looking forwards and backwards.
That was Ziggy Lever reading Image After Imago. Next, Isla Martin will read Spacious Atriums for a Modern Hine. Her contribution is founded in the abundance of meanings held within a series of kupu Māori. Isla's narrative text reflects a sense of spaciousness inherent in language and its capacity to resist or unravel ideas of a fixed identity.
Spacious Atriums for a Modern Hine. Iwi. Noun. Extended kinship group, tribe, nation, people, nationality, race, often refers to a large group of people descended from a common ancestor and associated with a distinct territory. The marae is locked. I consider staging my own death, causing the catalyst for a tangi. It turns out, my cousin said, if you respect the river, it'll never kill you, even if you ask. I use auntie's toilets in the campground's office. I take a photo of the locked gate, the atea fishnetted by the middle. On the banks, I put my ankles in and say he honore in that place behind my eyes. I do not believe in one atua, but it's the only one I know. We say it every morning in class before fire is fired. It's a gravel road to the convent. I know about the poet, so I'm looking for this house. I don't yet know about the raping. In the kitchen, a brown nun takes $5 a head for the night. I don't yet know how many greens there are, but I can see them all. I can smell the dirt. I sleep in the infirmary bed on the upper floor. A paradox, really. The waiting to be murdered by what's beyond the plastic drape and the lack of concern about it. I say to Ma when I'm urbanised again, about the way the fog rolls on the river in the morning, about the writing a fake prayer in the chapel and leaving it on the altar, about Mother Mary in stone in the garden. I say to her about these villages I am possessed by, about tipuna and graves and birds. She says she regrets my Scottish name. In Tūrangi, I consider death too. I know it like the back of my hand, which is an emergency exit from where I came, which is the wet earth and each star that led us here. I know I want to be a hot body, like really geothermal, brown and smelling like sinew. I am a child floating, not yet city thrusting or yearning for another kind of sun, all artificial. I'm sober, looking at the forest floor, saying, I know you from somewhere. Maybe from somewhere in my digestive tract, or in auntie's house where we chat up the whakapapa over elderflower cordial, about how it's more circle than line, about how hinewai is a synonym for every kui that ever lived. By God, it is almost meningococcal to wash in my own body of water. In Tūrangi, I consider just laying me down with the weta. Fuck, I feel Māori when I'm not scared. When crater lakes steam the phlegm from my shell and it comes up half vomit, half karangamai, karangamai, karangamai ra. Noun. Strength. Bone. In this city, it costs more to live by the airport than by the sea. We get stoned in the car at the end of the runway, waiting for the Emirates A380, laughing as the richest boys chant, my dad is your dad's boss, when they score a try. Try harder. I reckon there's a swamp beneath us all, a cathedral in the abdomen, and Ruaimuku in our decade of dreaming. Claire's brother swimming in the burst drain is what I remember, and burnouts too. Babes cruising Colombo, soy milk in the tussock at Taylor's, and driving down Linwood Ave in my bra. Mine are the bodies high and dry, in the back seat, orange sundown coming in hot. Mine are the kicks on the dash, in the flotsam, the kaiapoi preachers, perfume like sausage and fire. I run until there's a meadow to scream in. I did not run out of Grace. Grace ran out of me. Mine are the Sunnysiders, the ones on leave, hurling up and go, looking for the stars buried on Brighton dunes, where the plastic sky turns out to be a memorial for something dead. Mine is the metropolis named for the worshipped and the place to worship him, just in case we forget. In case we spend too long in Rapaki and start using big words like rangatiratanga or tamatea pōkai whenua, who called the heat to come home. Mine is the city muted, been in on Stanmore, buying poppy seeds for the tea we take lukewarm in pump bottles up the bridal path, realising halfway that we'd be terrible settlers because you can't colonise what you're too high to climb. Mine is the city that smells like shit when the wind hits, unswimmable piss ponds in the nervous system. All of us here want to drive so fast we just lift off, want to lay down in a field until all the continents rise up to meet us where we're at, which is home adjacent, which is bone deep, which is a hustle of hips foaming at the mouth, saying, swim, swim, north to the light. Whenua. Noun. Country, land, nation, state. Noun. Ground. Noun. Territory, domain. I judged the music by whether or not, if I were in the passenger seat and we were hypothetically going full throttle up the Waitakere's, about to see God and my dead best friend bursting out the skies and salmon come tangerine, I would be frothing fear at the mouth or saying, I once was a machine but now I'm an ancestor. Put a weta on my spine and watch me dance. You could shoot up your amphetamines or you could just put your nose in this good damp earth, which smells like everything you don't yet know but could kill for, but would live for. Noun. Placenta. Afterbirth. Every bone of Polynesia, we would have been dangerous, but who wants to sprout from that anyway? Who wants their mother to have been scared, so much that what she carried was too shy to haggle the light, the lemon tree baby, big bang of my Pacific, you are a giant star. We would have been prayer flags slung like AK-47s on the wrong hip, but choke me if it saves the sun. Let's de-extinct the most beautiful bird we've ever seen, in the sky of mine forever, where the sound of the pilgrimage being worth it. It is a pulse. Whānau. Noun. Extended family, family group, a familiar term of address to a number of people, the primary economic unit of traditional Māori society. My koro lives in the northwest. I see his whare in clay beige and the car burning blue. It has a license plate with our Portuguese last name so as to say yes, I really love half my ancestors so much. My koro doesn't ask the kids over. I mean, if we were one body, which we are, all except the extremities would be gay and all including the extremities would be brown. My koro is rich with inheritance and we won't inherit it. He asks me if I've had my 21st yet and I say, 4 years ago, koro, and do you want a wine? He's sitting in the corner of the party, waiting for the little ones to come to him and remind him how to pronounce our names. When he hears Ratahuia, does it sting? When he hears Miriama, is it the strap? When he hears Te Aroha, is it like God? Fuck. When he hears Ruhia, is it like Hail Mary, Hail Mary? What about Tamihana? What about Hinewai? What about all the ones who haven't come yet but will come like open doors, like Waharoa, like the sun? Noun. To be born. Give birth. Doctor reckons I need the smear because statistics. Instead, I delay my own death via the avoidance of unknown numbers and thrice daily karakia. When I'm finally harpooned, snared into a chair that can only become a bed, I am too loud. The waiting room I witness, I say, no sugary strangers, no truck-laden streets, no after dark anything. I am dabbling in good decisions at last, and intuition too, which encourages me to kick, fight, turn ugly, be a dog, make fuss to the degree of conviction. I say no to your masters of women's health. I want you to strip back the curtain, rip the plastic, hold my hand, and let in Tamanui Te Rā, the only man I'll ever love except my brothers. Doc says the hikareti are killing my very big national family. Our lungs and livers and livelihoods are susceptible to a collective ruin any day now. Imagine, all of us Hawaiki bound on one hospital-sized waka, built from Māori sweat and tobacco discards, biopsy matter, half of 300 good used cervixes, vodka, and all of that leftover skin, calling the whales by name. What a party. I can see us now, winking up at the light. What say you, we charm them dead? Māori, noun. Māori, Indigenous New Zealander, Indigenous person of Aotearoa, New Zealand, a new use of the word resulting from Pākehā contact in order to distinguish between people of Māori descent and the colonisers. I go to Rongoā on Wednesdays at a place named after the dead cows and I love it. Prise me back to my loosest body. Speak my tongue over my head. Through the gap in the bed, I cry. Through the gap in the bed, I analyse the kaimahi socks. My dead best friend isn't traumatised anymore. Karikari is a portal. Modifier. Normal, usual, natural, common, ordinary. I learnt to karanga at university. I practiced, but it didn't come out how I needed it to. Where's the Māori in the courtyard? What is the kaupapa? Karanga mai, karanga mai, karanga mai ra. I'll do it better in real life, promise. Modifier. Native. Indigenous, fresh, of water, belonging to Aotearoa New Zealand, freely, without restraint, without ceremony, clear, intelligible. Hinewai says the only place your Māori is in your liver. Once again, I coughed up underwater and chunks of peace came out. It's like the skies are so well groomed for falling, they are singing Alleluia so pure, I swear I've seen something explode in the Pacific, perhaps in this room. Hinewai would fan herself dry with a whole pork. Noun. Aboriginal inhabitant, Indigenous person, native. Ko Ruapehu te maunga, ko Wanganui te awa, ko Aotea te waka, ko te Ati Haunui a Pāpārangi te iwi, ko Uenuku te hapū, ko te puke ki Raitihi te marae, ko au te awa, ko te awa ko au.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
That was Isla Martin reading Spacious Atriums for a Modern Hine. Next you will hear from Erin Lee reading Hallway Field Notes, about frustrating encounters with art in hallways. On one hand, Erin is sympathetic, miffed at passers-by ignoring the art. On the other hand, she is disappointed by the poor selection of art for these awkward spaces.
Hallway Field Notes by Erin Lee. A hallway is a thoroughfare, designed to deliver us from point A to point B. It directs our bodies away from the walls as we move past them, onwards and outwards to our destination. There's a flow and a pull through the space, from one end to the other, keep to the left, or risk getting tangled in the oncoming traffic of other bodies. But if you do stop, if you do linger, you become an obstruction, at odds with the people who are, quite reasonably, using a hallway as a hallway. For a few years I've been collecting experiences of artworks in hallways, like I do with pretty shells on the beach, taking them home only to add them to a purposeless amassed pile. Though I don't know exactly why, my ambivalent feelings about art exhibited in hallways have persisted. First hallway, Auckland Art Gallery, Toyo Tamaki, ground floor. AAG has branded the space as a long gallery. A gallery in name only, the corridor connects the foyer to the south atrium. More often than not, I've found that this stretched and compressed passageway undercuts my experience of whatever work is hung along the wall. It feels like the otherwise bare walls are adorned with something to simply fill the void where real estate is at a premium. I remember Lindau portraits of Tipuna Māori displayed along the eastern wall of the hall. I bristled at the sight of fellow gallery goers only glancing at the portraits as they walked past, quickly moving from one part of the gallery to another. Although, quite reasonably, a hallway is designed to make passers-by of us all. Second hallway, Auckland Art Gallery, Toyo Tamaki, first floor. When the Louise Henderson survey was exhibited at AAG, the massive canvases that make up her magnum opus, The 12 Months, were hung in a hallway. Trying to get back far enough to look at them all together was thwarted by the other wall pressing against your back. The length of the space stretched the paintings apart and isolated them as standalone works rather than distinct pieces of a whole. In contrast, when this touring show was hung in CAG, I was reintroduced to Henderson's Seasons in a larger room that let them breathe and expand. The room was big enough to have a seat on the opposite wall that invited you to spend time with them. It gave you enough space to see them all at once, see their relationships with each other, far from the experience in the AAG hallway which hurried you along and spat you out. Third hallway, Christchurch Art Gallery, Te Puna o Waiwhetu, ground floor. There's a hallway next to the front desk at CAG that leads to the toilets. There tends to be a video work hung at the mouth of the corridor, right under the sign for the Wharepaku. At the moment, there's one by Marie Shannon. I was ready to be indignant at this positioning, but I ended up quite enjoying it. Car Stories is shot POV, driving along a rural road, while a voiceover by Shannon recalls the stories about the cars of her life. There's something about this work that undoes the effect of the thoroughfare. The momentum offered by the screen sets a trajectory at odds with the up and down, in and out flow of the hallway. The same way you get sucked into any screen, this one creates its own space and dimension beyond the confines of the hallway. I think video works well here because it gives you permission to pause and watch. If you're in someone's pathway, it's okay because you're watching an artwork. It's just a little awkward when your view is interrupted by someone who just needs to get past you to use the loo. Fourth hallway, University of Auckland Business School, Owen G. Glenn Building, third floor. The OGB building is bizarre. On the third floor, there's a sharply curved wall with hallways running down either side. Wrapped around this wall is Origins, always, in these islands, meeting and parting, shake us, make us tremulous the salt-rimmed air, by Max Gimlet. This floor-to-ceiling ceramic mural consists of clay doodles scattered across a blue wall. On the website for the university's art collection, the mural looks fine. However, within this functioning hallway, this artwork falls apart, literally. The lifespan of ceramics isn't long when they are placed in a crowded hallway with tote-bagged students, of which I was one, jostling past each other, trying to get in and out of the same small spaces simultaneously every hour on the hour. As a protective measure, a line of white electrical tape on the floor sits about a foot out from the wall, running the length of the mural. But the sad little line has no hope of commanding any authority in the hallway. The hordes of business school students don't see it, let alone abide by it. They could have taken a cue from Owen Connors. In brackets, read on. Fifth hallway, Parasite Gallery, stairwell. All this is not to say that hallways are inherently bad places to display and experience art. Daniel John Corbett Sanders' Parasite Gallery, which was on Karangahape Road from 2020 to 2022, was homed in a hallway-slash-stairwell hybrid that led to Sanders' apartment. The compressed hallway served to exhibit LGBTQ+ artists who are routinely excluded from more palatial galleries. Owen Connor's tempera paintings in For Future Breeders found a way to nestle themselves in, sinking into holes cut into the plasterboard so that the paintings were flush with the wall. Still, the hallway squished you up against the works in a way that felt like squeezing past a friend in a crowd.
That was Erin Lee reading Hallway Field Notes. Thank you for listening to this selection of audio from Correspondence Issue 2.1. Also included in this issue is a contribution from Balamohan Shingade and Nkosi Nkululeko, titled Correspondence Game 2022-23, Tarokan Advanced Variation B12. This contribution takes the form of an email exchange in parallel with a game of chess. The game will be concluded in Correspondence Issue 2.2, scheduled to launch in June. You will be able to hear the entire reading from both issues and find out who wins in a future episode of Art Not Science. Our current exhibition, Back Dirt, features new commissions by Ōtautahi-based artist Priscilla Rose Howe and Pōnuku-based artist and curator Daniel John Corbett Sanders. Figurative works by the artists register joy, discomfort, appetite, anger. Collectively, the works recall and imagine queer experiences as a space of possibility. As always, the Physics Room is open Tuesday to Friday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Saturday to Sunday from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. We are located on the ground floor at 301 Montreal Street, entrance via Market Square car park. Thank you for listening. Tune in next month on Friday the 21st of April at 8 p.m. for our next episode of Art Not Science. Mā te wā.
The Physics Room is generously supported by Creative New Zealand, the Christchurch City Council, the Rata Foundation, Three Boys Brewery, Scientech, and the Crater Rim.